I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, in two separate decisions today, the Supreme Court first upheld the legality of an affirmative action program at the University of Michigan Law School. But the court struck down a second University of Michigan point-based admission policy that assigned credits based on race. In another ruling today, the court said that Congress can force libraries to block access to pornographic websites from public computers. Lyle Denniston is the Supreme Court reporter with the Boston Globe. And Lyle joins us now from Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us, Lyle.
You're most welcome. Glad to be here.
Thanks, Lyle. Lyle, first, two decisions on race-based admissions, one involving an application to the law school, two to the University of Michigan's undergraduate program. Bottom line here, both decisions upheld the principle of affirmative action, right? What was the difference?
Well, the difference was that Justice O'Connor, who wrote the opinion upholding the law school program, and, by the way, the more important opinion because that validates the use of race in college admissions programs, joined the Chief Justice and the other dissenters in the law school program in finding that the undergraduate program would not pass constitutional muster because of the way it was constructed around a rigid allocation of 20 points for minorities.
So it was the methodology used for race-based admissions in the undergraduate school that was the problem there.
Right. The principle is still the same as to both schools and as to other institutions that will be affected by this. That is, you may use race as a factor. It can't be the only factor. It cannot result in a quota or fixed percentage of your entering students. You may use it, but when you do use it, you mustn't use it in narrowly tailored terms. You cannot make race the predominant factor. It's got to be only one among the other factors. And all of this has to focus on each individual applicant. You can't do it in a group basis.
Now, critically here, this is the first major decision by the Supreme Court on race-based admission since the late 70s. And this is a much more conservative court than the liberal court of the late 70s. So this is a real blow to those who oppose affirmative action, yes?
Well, it was a particularly hard blow for them because they were, at least in rational terms, entitled to believe that the Supreme Court would do in higher education what it has already done in redistricting legislatures, in government jobs, and in government contracting. That is, essentially to forbid the use of race as a deciding factor. And the court has today just simply created a very large exception to a very well-established trend over the last 10 years or so of forbidding the use of race as a predominant factor in public policymaking.
Let's shift our focus in the minute or so we have left, Lyle. Let's talk about that ruling on porn filters in public libraries. A federal court in Pennsylvania ruled last year that the law was unconstitutional because it caused libraries to violate the First Amendment because those porn filtering programs block out a lot of other legitimate information, too, right? Briefly,
yes.
What does this boil down to?
Well, this boils down to a judgment by the court that when libraries are picking the points of along the web where patrons can have access, they are essentially doing the same things that they do when they select books to put on their shelves. In other words, they're not violating their patrons' First Amendment rights to read or to see. They're simply making editorial judgments, in this case under a mandate from Congress, but the court has treated this as simply making editorial judgments about content.
I see. Lyle Denniston, thanks so much for joining us on Here and Now.
Happy to be here.
Lyle Denniston is the Supreme Court reporter with the Boston Globe. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
It's been 38 years since the country's first Head Start program opened its doors to 3- and 4-year-old at-risk youngsters. They get an early jump on education, and they get breakfast, dental care, and routine vaccinations, and everyone agrees the program works. Well, now the Bush administration is proposing sweeping changes to the way Head Start is administered, and some are concerned. Joining us to talk about the proposed changes is Dr. George Askew, the former chief of health and disabilities for Head Start, the executive director of Docs for Tots, and a Head Start grad himself. Welcome, Dr. Askew.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the biggest change in the Bush proposal is the funding, that it would be given to the state instead of being directly implemented by the federal government. Why are some seeing this as a problem?
There is a risk that the comprehensive nature of the program will be lost. I think at a time of tight fiscal budgets, when you're shifting monies to the states to take care of a program that has a wonderful infrastructure already in place, you run the risk that kids will not continue to receive the same types of services that they've been receiving now that have proved to be effective.
Well, and in fact, the Bush administration does agree that the Head Start program is overwhelmingly better than the current state-run programs. And their point is, in the Bush administration, let's move more money to the states, and that will strengthen those state-run programs as well. In other words, Head Start will pull everybody up.
My concern, again, with that is you're taking a program that is effective and potentially diluting and dismantling that program in the hopes that it's going to bring up state programs, which, as you said, have not proved to be effective. Mm. And I don't think that that's necessarily the way to go, especially if you're doing it without having very specific, very comprehensive guidance on the level and quality of services that are to be offered and having some accountability for what comes out of these programs.
Let's talk about that. The father of Head Start, Dr. Edward Ziegler, says that there are some worthwhile goals that the administration is looking at, you know, strengthening other programs, but he agrees that they're going about it the wrong way. That in particular, two elements, parental participation and the quality control, would be damaged. Tell us about those.
Having parents involved, I think, is even more difficult these days with respect to welfare to work and folks going back into the workforce, and the time being able to spend with Head Start programs is certainly impacted. But Head Start continues to do a very good job of educating parents and keeping them involved. And again, one of my concerns, and in my pediatric practice, is I see parents of young children who should be in Head Start or should be in a quality child care program can't get in because there's not enough money in that program as it is. When you say Head Start's doing wonderfully, it is, but it's still not funded to the level it should be funded. Right. And these parents could truly benefit from having parent education, parenting classes, to help them do a better job.
And, Doctor, others make the point that this might be a particularly bad time to entrust more money to the states. They're cutting everything.
Exactly. If I'm a state, this is a very appealing option. Well, gee, you're going to give me money. That would be fantastic. I can use it at my discretion to some degree. If this happens, that you have to have very, very specific guidelines, quality control with respect to the level and quality of services that are going to be offered. You can't educate a child who is not physically well nor has the social and emotional foundations for school readiness.
And Dr. Askew, how much of this is a power play? One sidebar to this story is that Head Start workers have been admonished by the Bush administration not to speak out against the potential changes. They're suing for the right to do so, but putting that aside, is there a sense that this might be a loss of jobs of Head Start workers, that these jobs might go to other state workers?
Well, I think when you say we should put that aside, I think that's the way we should look. At least in my mind, this is about the kids. This is about what is best for children.
Real quick before we let you go, it's universally agreed that this program works. You were a product of it. What was your favorite part of Head Start?
I think what it meant for me and my family was it got us over the hump, and I think set the stage for a successful family life. My parents have now been married for more than 40 years, and a successful career for me, at least I'd like to think so.
Well, I think you're quite right. Doctor, thank you.
My pleasure.
Dr. George Askew, the former chief of health and disabilities for Head Start, the executive director of Docs for Tots, and as we said, a Head Start grad himself.
When it comes to teaching, you don't generally get into it for the money. But Eric Jolma's at the low end of even teachers' generally low-end salaries, earning just a little less than $20,000 a year. But Jolma accepts that. He loves what he does, and he knows there's not a lot of money around in very rural Winnett, Montana. And because it's tough to get teachers where the nearest movie theater's 53 miles away, Eric's something of a Renaissance man, teaching 6 courses in all, biology, chemistry, physics, and the physical earth and life sciences. And that's the problem. Teaching all that could cost Eric his job. Eric Jolma joins us on the line now from Winnett, Montana. Eric, welcome.
Hello.
Eric, what's the problem here? It seems to have something to do with President Bush's No Child Left Behind program that's now federal law, right?
Yeah, the new law says that you have to be highly qualified to teach each subject. So teaching 6 different subjects is kind of hard to be highly qualified. I think they define that as having, you know, a degree in each of those areas.
A college degree in each of those areas.
Yeah. I have a wife and three kids, so it'd be kind of tough to just drop everything and go to college.
Now, Eric, so you just said you could conceivably go back to college, although that's an expensive proposition. There's also another alternative, isn't there? Something called a competency exam?
Oh, yeah, I just read something about that.
What do you know about that?
Nothing, really.
Nothing, really.
It's out there and available, I guess.
Whereby you would take a test that would determine whether you were competent to teach these various things you teach.
Yeah.
I guess it sounds like there's a lot of unanswered questions out there.
There's a lot of unanswered questions,
yeah. Yeah. How threatened do you feel? How likely do you think it is that you could actually lose your job because of this federal law? It's not a problem under state law, right?
No. Under state law, it's fine. I don't think it's that big of a problem. Well, I hope not, because there's a lot of schools in Montana in the same boat, and there's a lot of people that would be in the same situation that I'm in.
You know other teachers who are in the same boat.
Yeah, there's one right across the hall from me, for sure, the social studies department.
Yeah, and what does that person teach in the social studies department? Are they kind of spread a little bit thin, too, on various subjects?
Yeah, he teaches Montana history and world history and American history and government and civics. And I think he's even got a psychology class this year coming up.
And he just doesn't have a degree in every single one of those subjects.
No.
So how did you first hear about this dilemma?
The superintendent, he brought it up at a couple of our teachers' meetings. We have a Monday morning meeting. Every Monday we get together as a staff.
Yeah.
He talks things over then. So.
Yeah. Now, Eric, you teach all these courses. You're not making a lot of money. Well, why do you do it?
The lifestyle, I guess. The kids. It's great. A bunch of ranch kids are good to get along with. Having them for 6 years, you definitely get to know your students by the time they graduate.
I would imagine that people in Gwinnett, Montana are pretty independent-spirited people. How do you feel about the long arm of the federal government possibly reaching out there and preventing you from doing what you love to do?
Kind of ironic, really. Someone that far away could influence us clear out here, I guess.
Had you had any familiarity with the No Child Left Behind program before all this came up?
Yeah, because we were having to institute more tests, more standardized tests for all the kids, so it was taking more days away from the class time.
What will you do if you were to lose your position there in Gwinnett?
That's a good question. I don't know what I'd do. So I'd probably have to take another job doing something.
Well, Eric, we appreciate your work and we appreciate your speaking with us, and we'd like to check in with you as time goes on to see how this all turns out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
And keep up the good work. All the best to you.
Well, thank you.
Eric Jolma, we've been speaking to in Gwinnett, Montana, where he's a teacher teaching 6 courses in all.
And by the way, for more on Eric Jolma, he was profiled in a piece in today's New York Times. Just ahead, our D.C. roundtable on presidential candidate Howard Dean, Medicare, and ice cream. We'll explain.
And later in the show, it was a very good year for CEOs. Profits were flat, but their salaries weren't.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Well, you could have fooled us. It looked as if Howard Dean had been campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination for at least a year. But according to his spokeswoman, the former Vermont governor has only been having a dialogue with the American people. The official announcement comes today in Burlington, Vermont, where Dean will reap lots of media coverage and a new Vermont-based Ben & Jerry's ice cream sundae, Maple-Powered Howard. Well, joining us on the line from Washington are members of our D.C. roundtable. Andrea Stone reports for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
And Bill Douglas reports for Newsday. Hello, Bill.
How are you?
I'm just fine. Ice cream cones aside, does it matter, Bill, what a candidate says in an announcement?
Yes and no. I mean, an announcement is a curtain raiser. It lets the public know who the candidate is, what he's about. It's also designed to generate some semblance of media coverage, hopefully on the networks and hopefully free. But in the long run, it doesn't matter because no one's going to remember 6 months down the road what the governor said on his announcement. I remember in covering the Gore campaign in 2000, it seemed we had like three announcements, like three kickoffs, because the first one didn't get much coverage. The second one, maybe people didn't get. The third one, it was a different theme. So it matters to the candidate. It matters to the campaign. Months down the road with the public, it might not.
On the other hand, isn't it true that sometimes that opening announcement can have some volleys that we haven't heard?
It can, but more often than not, the candidates like to play it safe, just touch on basic themes, education, economy, in Dean's case, maybe the environment, just to sort of get the public in a getting-to-know-you mode.
Well, but in getting to know Howard Dean, Andrea, what might the public find? It's been said that he often shoots from the hip. He was quoted in the Boston Globe this morning. He said, New England Republicans are not the same as the right-wing wackos in Washington. Might we hear more of that?
Well, we might, and sometimes he shoots blanks. Yesterday he was on Meet the Press on NBC, and he could not answer a lot of the questions Tim Russert was asking him under very intense questioning.
Social Security.
Yeah, Social Security, the prescription drug plan. He wouldn't say whether he supported it or not. He was asked about a constitutional amendment to balance the budget. He wouldn't talk about that. He was asked about the same-sex couple ruling in Canada where homosexuals can now get married, and he was asked whether he thought that those people would be considered legally married in the U.S. Now, this is, when he was governor of Vermont. Vermont passed a civil union, the country's only civil union bill. He wouldn't answer it. So, he was very much lacking on the facts when it came to national security. He said he didn't know how many American military personnel were on active duty around the world. He didn't really know how many were in Iraq, and he said he didn't really have to know that other people like President Reagan, President Clinton, the current President Bush, who had been governors, didn't know much about it either, and that he had time to learn. So this was not what he probably wanted the day before he announced officially, but it was very revealing.
Well, Bill, he is the candidate right now with the most buzz. Is this something that might sting him?
No. Again, this early in the game, people's memories are short. If that continues while he's doing the day-to-day stuff, that's a problem. But if he shows that he does have a capacity to learn and he does show that he does have a grasp of some issues, he should be fine.
Hmm. Well, as an aside, we mentioned there's going to be a new Ben & Jerry's ice cream named in his honor, served in Vermont. But we want to point out Ben & Jerry's is now owned by Unilever. The original owner and now political activist Ben Cohen is with a group called Move On. They've endorsed Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah, so it's very interesting.
Nothing's easy. Well, let's look at the week ahead. The Senate is considering a measure regarding the federal program Medicare. They're considering drug coverage for the elderly and disabled. A reminder, Medicaid is the state-run program for the poor. Medicare is for the elderly and disabled. The Senate is set to pass this Medicare measure this week. It would cut, some say, many poor elderly from any Medicare drug coverage, force them over to the Medicaid programs. This, to many, would hurt the elder poor. Who does it affect politically?
Well, this is a $400 billion program, which sounds like a lot of money, but for prescription drugs for seniors, it's not a lot of money. And it's got a donut hole, they call it, right in the middle, so that if you have a lot of prescription drugs for part of the year, you wouldn't be covered. A lot of Democrats think that's bad. But the interesting thing is that one of the biggest supporters of this bill is Ted Kennedy. You don't get much more liberal than Ted Kennedy in the Senate, and yet he has angered a lot of his fellow Democrats by going for this. process. He says, you know, this is not perfect, but it's a starting point and we can build on it. But other Democrats, especially some of them who are running for president, are really upset about it because, this, you know, it sort of blurs the whole difference between Republicans and Democrats. If the president gets this bill through, he can go onto the campaign trail next year and say, look what I did for senior citizens.
Yeah. Well, one last question to you, Bill. This morning, the Supreme Court announced it has allowed the University of Michigan to use race in its admissions policy. Who wins politically on this decision?
Well, it was a split decision, in essence. The court ruled in favor of the University of Michigan, but they also didn't do the same with undergraduate admissions.
In the undergraduate school, you're referring to the fact that the Supreme Court threw out the use of a point system in considering race, but they did allow race to be considered.
Correct. So it's definitely a split, which could produce a pretty interesting split politically. It gives Republicans one less issue to say that they've accomplished or resolved. I mean, Bush has always talked about moving more towards a colorblind society and the bigotry, the soft bigotry of low expectations, and that we all need to be on a level playing field. On the other hand, that in turn might energize black voters. This gives the Democrats an issue that they can say, look what this court did. Look what a more conservative court could do if President Bush gets a Supreme Court pick in his second term.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Andrea Stone covers Congress for USA Today. Bill Douglas covers foreign affairs for Newsday. They're members of our weekly D.C. Roundtable.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, it's being called the biggest mass poisoning in history. Millions of people in Bangladesh being poisoned by arsenic in their drinking water.
Also, a monthly ritual in a bar in New Hampshire where they gather to sing sea shanties. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, coming up, business is bad, profits are down. So why is CEO pay going through the roof?
Nobody's been talking about 2002 as being one of the good years that we've had, and I cannot see any real justification for the increases in annual bonuses, which are supposed to reflect annual performance at the company.
Also, the infectious beat of the bossa nova.
Bossa nova also uses that, but it's...
Yeah, you can hear it.
I can hear it. These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. There's mixed reaction today to Supreme Court rulings on affirmative action. In twin rulings, the High Court upheld an affirmative action admissions policy at the University of Michigan Law School while striking down a stronger program for undergraduate admissions. Harvard Law School professor Lonnie Guineer is a longtime advocate of affirmative action.
It represents an important acknowledgement that race still matters in this country and that we have not overcome the legacy of slavery, of Jim Crow, and of continued discrimination.
David Gersten leads a group opposed to affirmative action.
This is a sad day for those of us who believe in equal opportunity and in colorblind law, which is actually what our Constitution was founded upon.
And in another ruling, the Supreme Court said libraries can be required to use internet filters to block pornography on their computers. U.S. senators visiting Iraq say American troops might remain in the country for as long as 5 years. Nebraska Republican Chuck Hagel says he does not think Americans have a notion of how long or how expensive the U.S. commitment will be. The Senate delegation met today with civilian administrator Paul Bremer. Officials in Iran say they have suspected members of al-Qaeda in custody, and they will hand them over to their home countries, including Saudi Arabia. That country and the U.S. have been pressuring Tehran to hand over suspected terrorists. Tehran has denied harboring terrorists and says it's held suspected al-Qaeda operatives for weeks. Palestinian officials say they could reach a ceasefire deal with Hamas by the end of the day. Egyptian officials say the announcement would be made in Cairo. Israeli officials insist the Palestinian prime minister crack down on terrorism, but Mahmoud Abbas says he'll first seek a ceasefire for fear of sparking a civil war. And a wildfire just north of Tucson, Arizona, continues to burn. The fire has charred more than 12,000 acres on Mount Lemmon and is still only 5% contained. On Wall Street, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 140 points at 9061. The Nasdaq Composite is behind 36 points at 1609. And the S&P 500 is down 15 at 981. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
It's a good time to be a corporate chief executive. Some might ask, when isn't? But last year, a year that saw share prices fall dramatically and corporate profits mostly flat, the CEOs of some of the biggest companies on the stock exchange took home an average pay increase of 60%. That's 60%. Have you had a raise like that lately? The 60% number comes from a report produced by Paul Hodgson of the Corporate Library, an independent investment research firm based in Portland, Maine. Hello, Paul.
Hi there.
Paul, 60% raise, spectacular numbers for anyone at any time. Can you, in a nutshell, explain it?
No, I can't. I was extremely surprised by the results this year. I was expecting it to be another year of fairly flat pay or even a pay decrease. But the figures have just confounded me.
Now, are these figures something that gets compiled by a whole different complex of bonuses and incentives and so forth? Or are these guys getting, or and perhaps hopefully women, getting flat pay increases of 50 or 60%.
No, most of the base salary rises have just about kept rise with or just over the level of inflation. The real drivers of the increase in pay have been the increase in incentives.
Now, explain to me what an incentive is.
Well, an incentive is supposed to be a reward for performance. Unfortunately, a lot of the incentives, especially the long-term incentives that are used to reward corporate officers, are not very closely based on a company's performance, and those include stock options and restricted stock, both of which we've seen growth in this year.
Corporate profits in general were down, right?
They were, certainly in some industries they were up, but overall I would have thought that they were down, yes. I mean, nobody's been talking about 2002 as being one of the good years that we've had, and I cannot see any real justification for the increases in annual bonuses, which are supposed to reflect annual performance at the company.
Now, who's making the decision for these corporate executives to get these increases?
Well, these are all approved by the board of directors and by the compensation committee on that board. Most of them are probably designed by pay consultants, but they're put in place by the board.
Any uproar from stockholders?
There has been a considerable uproar this year, certainly at the round of annual meetings. There have been stockholder proposal after stockholder proposal has objected to various elements of executive pay, particularly stock options and the golden parachutes that have been placed in line for executives who are terminated and often terminated for poor performance. But they still seem to walk away with 3 years' salary and bonus.
Now, are these men and women, these CEOs, such rare characters that maybe at the end of the day they can demand this kind of increase because they're thin on the ground, people who can run a whole company?
Well, that's certainly the press that they put out, and they like to believe their own press. There are plenty of companies out there where such compensation policies are not in place, and those companies don't seem to find it particularly difficult to hire CEOs or to breed CEOs from within the company.
Now, this is primarily an American phenomenon, right?
It is indeed. Such levels of compensation would not be acceptable anywhere from Japan to Germany. And the country with the closest kinds of compensation practices to the U.S., which is the U.K., there's been so much outrage and so much uproar in the U.K. over the sorts of practices that were being transferred over there from the U.S. that both the government and the London Stock Exchange stepped in to really put a very, very tight cap on pay growth there.
Paul Hodgson, thanks very much for joining us on this.
My pleasure.
Paul Hodgson is with The Corporate Library, an independent investment research firm based in Portland, Maine.
Well, while some CEO salaries went up on average 60%, shareholders' attempts to monitor those salaries rose as well. Shareholder resolutions, either to reform CEO pay or other company policy, rose 30%, and some even passed. And now the Securities and Exchange Commission is considering changes to allow shareholders an even bigger say, a role in electing members to corporate boards of directors. Joining us now is Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times. And Gretchen, tell us about some of the shareholder resolutions that have passed, first of all.
Well, most of the ones that were put forward, Robin, had to do, as you point out, with compensation. And in particular, there were several that involved tying the executive's compensation more closely to performance. As you know, we've seen stocks drop in value, and yet the CEO keeps getting a higher salary and compensation package. So I think that investors and shareholders have been, particularly enraged by that disconnect.
Well, for instance, Hewlett-Packard and Verizon voted to curb these golden parachutes when CEOs leave. Delta Airlines and Kimberly-Clark voted to treat stock options as an expense, big issue post-Enron.
Yes.
But are these resolutions binding?
Resolutions that are put forward by shareholders are never binding. It is pretty much a warning, sort of, to the CEOs that the shareholders are unhappy and that the CEO had better listen, but technically they do not have to abide by them.
Well, so they're not always binding. And as you know, some, including the Business Roundtable, object to them at all. They say that any changes that might come from these resolutions give too much power to a small amount of investors with an agenda.
Well, I would say phooey, because honestly, these people at the Business Roundtable are the CEOs who are making all the money, and the shareholders are not.
Talk about the proposed changes by the SEC, considering giving shareholders a possibility to vote for the board members. Why is that important?
It's important because this will be the first time in a very long time that the SEC is looking into allowing shareholders to have a lot more say. Historically, it has been near to impossible for shareholders, particularly small shareholders, to get any people that they feel would be better directors on the board.
And by the way, Gretchen, remind us, what happens? I mean, some boards are obviously terrific, but is this a problem because CEOs might stuff the board with people who would then pat them back on the back?
Absolutely. We've seen that the boards have been just tremendously a clubby place that is sort of a support system for the CEO, because that is who puts them on the board.
In your educated opinion, though, do you think this will pass, this idea that shareholders have a role in electing members to corporate boards? And do you think they'll participate?
Well, the difficulty is, and what this is what the SEC has to wrestle with, and I really don't know how it's going to come out, that you can't really let small investors make choices. I mean, it's awfully hard for an individual investor to know who would be a better board member. And the other thing is that how are they going to decide who will help the alternate slate be selected? Is it going to be only those investors that have a large stake, say 5% or more of the stock? Is it going to be some other way of measuring? I mean, then you have a situation where haves and have-nots, where you've got a situation where people are able to help control this in a way and others aren't, other shareholders are not. So there are some issues here that they're going to have a very difficult time wrestling with.
Well, it's something we'll keep an eye on. Gretchen, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Gretchen Morgenson writes about Wall Street for the New York Times.
Still to come, how Bossa Nova first flowered and a 72-year-old master still in full bloom.
You're listening to Here and Now. About 5 million copies of the newest Harry Potter book flew magically off the shelves this weekend, but left behind other tales of imagination overlooked because of the book that most kids have probably finished by now. That's why we invited 10-year-old Daniel Miller Medson, son of Here and Now producer Karen, to join Lindsay Crudell at a bookstore to share some of his other favorites.
Hi, I'm Daniel. And I'm 10 years old.
What's your favorite book in the whole world? Show me.
Well, I don't really have a favorite book, but there are some that I really like.
Like what?
There was one that I just finished reading recently called The Giver. It's one of the best books I've ever read. It's by Lewis Lowry. Yeah, that's it. It's a book about a kid named Jonas. Finds out he has the power to receive these memories. It's an amazing book.
So what are some of the books that you and your friends are reading right now?
Well, me and my friends, you know, we have different opinions on what we like, but most of my friends are reading the Artemis Fowl series. First Door was the first one, and everybody really liked it. It's about a mastermind genius, Artemis Fowl, who... his father disappears, and, you know, it's just about him. He becomes a criminal, and he's, you know, a multimillionaire. It's amazing. Then he made a second one where he finds out his father is alive, and he has to save his father.
What is it about them that you like so much?
Well, it's the mix of technology and, you know, it's like real life, except technology is a little bit over. Over here, there are some Roald Dahl books, which he's a really great writer, and I'm upset that he died before he could write more books.
Tell me about this one.
It's called The BFG. The BFG stands for The Big Friendly Giant. It's about a girl who wakes up and she sees a giant, and when she sees the giant finds out that she's seen him, and he says, I have to take you back to my world because you're not allowed to see me and tell anybody else. I think that this is a great book.
So when you read a book and you get to the end and you close that back cover, and you go, man, that was a great book. Yeah. How would you describe a really great book?
It's a mix of things. Like, to be really great, it doesn't necessarily have to be adventurous, doesn't necessarily have to be sad, but certain books that end that are sad and stuff, they're really good. Like The Giver, like things happen near the end that are not very happy. And then other books like Harry Potter, where it's at the end most things are very adventurous, and the books that end cliffhanging, those are good too.
So are you planning on writing a book of your own someday?
I actually am in the middle of writing a book right now. It's sort of like Artemis Fowl. I use that a little bit like a model. I'm using my friends' names and my names in the book. The head bad guy's name is Daniel Manzaro.
Can I be in the book?
I don't think so.
By the way, Daniel also recommends The Bogard by Susan Cooper and The School Story by Andrew Clements. Well, what are some of your favorites? For Daniel's titles or to share some of your own, visit our website, here-now.org.
It's Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Sometimes all it takes is just one hit, music that just suddenly, kind of mysteriously, takes over to put a whole musical style on the map. Think, for example, Bill Haley and the Comets, Rock Around the Clock, and what it did for rock and roll. I guess you could also mention Elvis's Hound Dog, too, or along the lines of the Brazilian musical style known as Bossa Nova. We could bring up the song Girl from Ipanema.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. When she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently, that when she passes, each one she passes goes,
That's Astra Gilberto singing the international and enduring sensation, Girl from Ipanema, a song written by Astra Gilberto's husband at the time, the great João Gilberto, without whom Bossa Nova would never have set the whole world swaying. To sort out how Bossa Nova was born and what it is and why it still endures, we're joined now by Here and Now's jazz aficionado, James Isaacs. Welcome, James.
Hi, Bill.
Before we get to João Gilberto, who at 72, by the way, is again touring the United States this summer, first, Bossa Nova. What is it?
Well, the term Bossa Nova translates to new wave or new beat. It came from the Brazil of the mid to late 1950s, but it came most importantly from two men, the composer, Antonio Carlos Jobim, and the singer and guitarist, João Gilberto. Think of Jobim as Gershwin, and think of Gilberto as Sinatra.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about João Gilberto. Why is he so important to the music?
In Brazil, he's called Omito, which means the legend, Omito. Gilberto was a great phraser. He's not a great singer by any means. His voice is small, his tone is nasal, but he knows exactly where to place the notes. And boy, if you can do that, you can write your own ticket in this life. Another important aspect of what he did, and you'll hear it, is that he has this singularly stuttering, lightly strummed, exquisitely timed style on the guitar. You hear that? It's dun, 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 dun. That's it. That's the bossa nova rhythm right there. Que é pra acabar com esse negócio de viver longe de mim. Não quero mais esse negócio de você viver assim.
Bossa nova is jazz.
Bossa nova has jazz leanings. It employs jazz harmonies. And it certainly has been interpreted many, many, many times by the greatest of all jazz artists. But what it really is the soul of Brazilian music after samba. The samba rhythm is a staccato feeling. Bossa nova is more stretched out, more legato. Maybe I should try to demonstrate here. Samba is something like this. If the tempo is...
Sounds about right.
You want that dun, 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 the heartbeat there. Bossa nova also uses that, dun, 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 but it's...
You can hear it.
That's more stretched out.
You pulled it off.
Well, I hope so.
Where did Gilberto and Jobim come up with it? Why did it happen? It was the 60s.
Well, it was the 50s. I'm not sure.
I guess it kind of reached us in the 60s up here. But
well,
yeah,
it did.
Sure.
1962 yeah. was the watershed year for bossa nova in America, thanks to Stan Getz and Charlie Bird's album called Jazz Samba, which featured the song Desafinado. This was the last big thing before the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and the Rolling Stones. Yeah. This really was. Once Stan Getz and Charlie Bird broke through, Gilberto and Jobim were invited to tour America and record with Stan Getz, and the bossa nova wheel was rolling.
Se você disser que eu desafino amor, saiba que isto em mim provoca imensa dor. Só privilegiados têm ouvido igual.
Now, Bill, we just heard a snippet of João Gilberto's interpretation of Desafinado, which loosely translates to out of tune. And that was recorded in the year 2000. As far as I know, that's Gilberto's most recent U.S. album. And you could really hear, because it was just the man and his guitar, that stuttering, exquisitely timed style that I told you about, and the thumb playing the bass notes, and it's so beautiful.
É que os desafinados também têm coração. Fotografei você na minha Rolleiflex. Revelou-se a sua enorme ingratidão. Só não poderá falar assim do meu amor.
Bossa nova still going strong?
Well, going strong. Certainly the songs, especially Jobim's, which is among the most profitable catalogs of any in popular music, those songs are going to be covered forever and ever, as long as people are interested in songs with gorgeous melodies and beautiful lyrics. Even if they're in Portuguese, you know, I've been listening to this music now for 40 years.
Sure.
I know some Portuguese words, but the language itself is so lovely that, you know, the effect comes across nonetheless.
The language is the kind of music itself. Other artists, just briefly, who are doing bossa nova now?
Well, these come to mind. Caetano Veloso, he is one of the most purposefully eclectic artists around, and only part of what he does is bossa nova, but he is a huge fan of Jobim and Gilberto. Gilberto's own daughter, Bebel Gilberto, although she has kind of a high-tech/remixed take on sambas, bossa novas. Jacques and Paula Morellenbaum, he is a cellist, she is a vocalist. And then Jobim's own children, Daniel Jobim and Paulo Jobim. Mm. So the legacy certainly is being carried on.
Well, let's go back to the master to finish up. João Gilberto, what song shall we go out on?
Gilberto doesn't sing always in Portuguese. Sometimes he sings in English, and in this case, he sings in Italian. This is one of the best ballads to have surfaced in the last 20 years. It's called Estate, and fittingly enough, Estate means summer. João Gilberto.
Estate. Sei calda come il bacio che ho perduto. Sei piena di un amore che è passato. Cuore mio vorrebbe cancellar estate, il sole che ogni giorno ci scaldava, che splendidi tramonti dipingeva.
João Gilberto singing Summer.
Everything he does has such subtle sensuality, maybe not even so subtle. It's very sensual music, and I'm thrilled that he's going to be touring this country.
Yeah, me too. James Isaacs, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Bill, and I'll see you soon.
James Isaacs is Here and Now's jazz aficionado. For more information on João Gilberto and Bossa Nova, check out our website at here-now.org.
And this note before we go. Earlier in our Washington, D.C. roundtable, I said that the activist group Move On had endorsed a presidential candidate. They have not. Ben Cohen, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's, has endorsed Democratic candidate Dennis Kucinich, but Move On will hold member elections to decide the group's candidate.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Piena di un amore che è passato, che il cuore mio vorrebbe cancellare.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.